I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is former New York City Police Commissioner Ray Kelly. He's joined in conversation by San Francisco Deputy of Chief of Staff and Public Safety Director Paul Henderson. And now join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Ray Kelly and Paul Henderson. Ray Kelly's first stint as New York City Police Commissioner was under Mayor David Dinkins, where he oversaw the police response to the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and spearheaded programs that would help usher in the city's historic drop in crime. 8 years later, in the chaotic wake of the 9/11 attacks, newly elected Mayor Michael Bloomberg tapped Kelly to be New York City's top cop once again. After a decade working with Interpol, serving as an undersecretary of the Treasury for enforcement, overseeing U.S. Customs, and commanding an international police force in Haiti, Ray Kelly transformed the NYPD from a traditional police department into a resource-rich counterterrorism and intelligence force. Ray Kelly was on the front lines of two of the most important issues of our time, confronting terrorism and dealing with the issues of race and policing. He is an unapologetic champion of stop and frisk, which has become a flashpoint in the current furor over police conduct in New York and around the country. He criticizes current New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio for what he sees as a craven surrender to politically motivated anti-cop activists. Currently president of risk management services for a real estate company, Ray Kelly is here tonight with his new book, Vigilance, My Life Spent Serving America and Protecting Its Empire City. He appears in conversation with Paul Henderson, San Francisco Deputy Chief of Staff and Public Safety Director. Please welcome them both to the JCCSF.
All right.
I'd like to welcome you, Mr. Kelly, coming back to California. I know you lived out here briefly in 1965 in Oceanside.
You're right. Well,
one of the things that I just want to make sure that I mention is that you talk about in the book being a longtime Giants fan. So welcome to San Francisco.
Well, guess what I did? I went to the game last night.
Oh, did you?
And, it didn't turn out the way I wanted it. And in the book, I say that Willie Mays was my favorite player, and I actually have a jersey, 24, signed by Willie Mays. So, yeah, I feel right at home here as far as sports are concerned.
Well, welcome back.
Good to be here. Thank you, Paul.
Sure. So I would say, let's just jump right on into it. I would argue that you are most well known as being the police commissioner and for your work with anti-terrorism. So those are the things that I kind of want to focus on. I'm not aware of any other police commissioner that has served two non-consecutive terms. Is there one in the history?
The current commissioner, Bill Bratton, followed me. So he was commissioner. He followed me the first time, and he followed me the second time.
And early on, would you say that as part of your work, did you involve yourself in a lot of politics in terms of your philosophy and your approach to the work that you do? Or
early on, as a police officer?
Absolutely. No. Moving up through the ranks.
No, not really. I wasn't involved in politics at all. I had a unique experience, though, when I was a sergeant. Mayor Lindsay was mayor. And I had a commander who, in a precinct, I was in what they call anti-crime work, plainclothes attire. I had a team, and we were working in East Harlem. But I had a commander who I respected a lot. He went to a unit called the Crime Prevention Unit, and he asked me to go with him. I did, and it turned out that there was a program that they were putting in place there called the Block Security Program,
right?
Which, believe it or not, Mayor Lindsay was going to use part of that as a stepping stone to run for president. So I got there, and this program was only a program in name only. Nobody had done any substantive work. So I found myself putting this program together, making all the rules and regulations, and I was only a sergeant at the time. I was actually drawing pictures for the pamphlets. I did everything but wash the windows there. And he took me to Washington, where he testified at a committee hearing. And I saw, you know, I really got sort of an in-depth look at how the city worked, because he was testifying on this
right.
program. As I say, he wanted to use it as a springboard to run for president. The idea was that blocks, areas in the city would put up money. They received matching funds from the city for hardware, for locks, alarms, to change the street lights. It was an anti-crime measure. This was in the early 70s. Crime was rampant in New York City, and this was his effort to sort of break out of the pack.
And what do you think about you and the work that you were doing made you stand out for him to select you to bring you along with him to explain or articulate how well the program was going?
Well, this commander that I respected, I think, told them about me. And also, at that time, I had just graduated law school, you know, I think just about that time. So there weren't too many lawyers in the police department at that time.
And so now, when you look back on how you started your career within the ranks of the police department and moving up, has your philosophy about the local, state, or national politics changed in terms of how you approached your job or how you executed your job?
Not really. I think I've never been really politically involved, but I've been aware of the politics. Maybe I was naive. Maybe it was going on around me and I didn't know it.
Well, it seems to have served you well throughout your career. I'm interested a little bit in the choices that you've made after you left the first time and you ended your position as police commissioner. You ultimately ended up doing some work at the federal level, being involved even internationally with policing. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's a couple of things. After I left, a few months after I left, I went to NYU. I was on the faculty, and I was with a security company, IGI, it was called. And I was asked to go to Haiti. There was an intervention. If you recall, President Aristide was sort of expelled from the country. There was an effort to get him back. And a U.S. ship had pulled in and it was not allowed to dock. So the tensions were rising. Ultimately, there was a decision to put President Aristide back in power, and the U.S. military was going to do it. There was reports of a lot of brutality on the part of the Haitian police and also what they call attachés, sort of like auxiliary police. The army did not want to be the police of Haiti. So
The
U.S. Army did not want to police Haiti. So I was asked to run something called the International Police Monitors. It consisted of about 1,300 individuals, about 800 professional police from 20 countries who spoke six languages, about 300 interpreters, and about another 150 different U.S. military personnel, all under one umbrella. So that was a great experience for me. I loved it. It was exciting. Haiti is a place, you know, desperate in many ways, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, but great people. I had a lot of great experiences. Some of them are in this book. Then after that, shortly thereafter, I was asked by Bob Rubin, who was the Secretary of the Treasury, to become the Undersecretary of Treasury. Now, at that time, U.S. Treasury had about 40% of all federal law enforcement in it. So it needed someone to sort of oversee what was going on. This was after Ruby Ridge was basically a Justice Department issue, but Waco
In Texas,
which,
right.
ATF was the agency involved, and that was a Treasury agency. So Secret Service, ATF, U.S. Customs, Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, and the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center.
Those are a lot of different agencies. Was it difficult?
Right.
And when you spoke about your experience in Haiti, I would presume that this is somewhat similar, where you're coming into a situation and you're dealing with very different agencies all doing very focused work. What was that experience like for you when you came in terms of managing how those different departments were going to relate with each other and then relate to your management
style?
Yeah,
it was an eye-opener. I saw how complex the federal government was and the power and the force of Congress. You always had to... At that time, we had a Democratic administration and the Republican Congress. So everything was somewhat adversarial. So you had to work your way through that minefield. And the agencies themselves were disparate in functions. I ultimately demoted myself to customs commissioner because the customs commissioner was reporting to me. He decided to leave the job, and I interviewed, along with my staff, 14 candidates, three finalists, submitted them to Bob Rubin. He didn't like any of them, or didn't select any of them. And so I volunteered. How about me? I pulled like a Dick Cheney, you know, looking for,
But why did you make that decision? I thought that was really curious that you made a decision to volunteer yourself to essentially take what could be considered a demotion into a smaller agency
perspective. It was a non-beltway move, as he said. But I wanted a hands-on job. Customs was then, still is, and now it's Customs and Border Protection, an agency of about 20,000 people. It covered over 400 ports of entry. Then it had a very robust agenda, things to do, and I saw a lot of potential there for making meaningful change. So it was a lot more fun, if I dare say the word. I enjoyed the job a lot more. Whereas the politics of Washington was more a factor in being an undersecretary than it was in being a customs commissioner.
I'm curious, when you come to a new agency or a new assignment, like, what is your approach? What are you thinking? What are your priorities in terms of figuring out what you're going to do to develop your leadership style or to manage or organize the agencies that you approach?
Well, every situation a little bit different. In customs, I knew, because they were reporting to me, I knew, generally speaking, what they were doing. I knew where there were some challenges. Now, with customs, not to digress, but with customs, there was a personal search issue. There were lawsuits, about 90 lawsuits.
I'm familiar with the lawsuits.
Again, were alleging racial discrimination in terms of who's being stopped at the border, that sort of thing. So that sort of surfaced as a big issue going in. And also the Senate Finance Committee was going to do a hearing on customs involving that to a certain extent. And I had to focus on that personal search issue. Now, at the border, you only need mere suspicion. You
Correct.
Don't need reasonable
It's a different
suspicion.
Standard.
So, you know, the standards were basically very, very low. They were non-existent. What I did was to create a committee early on, and head of the committee was African-American woman who was head of the Smithsonian Institute, Constance Newman. She was terrific. And I brought other people on board. John Lewis, famous
congressman.
John Lewis, right? Mm-hmm. Iconic congressman. He was also involved. And
African-American civil rights leader.
Absolutely. You know, Martin Luther King.
Yes.
Companion, I guess. Anyway, we were able to change the protocols. I actually put protocols in place that reduced the number of searches by 75%. And this is before 9/11. Increased the number of drug fines by 25%,
right,
because that was a major issue in those days. It just put structure in place. required a supervisor to approve any search or any pat down. So John Lewis praised us. I had a press conference announcing this, and he was there.
Right.
So to get back to your point, you have to look at each agency differently, or each place that you go. And that was sort of the overarching issue that we had to deal with before we did anything else in customs.
I just don't want to lose that. It is no small feat to receive praise from Civil Rights Leader John Lewis on how you conduct searches in terms of a leadership position.
Oh, we're very proud of that, yeah.
That's a big deal. Can you tell me, how did the lawsuits affect how you approached addressing that issue, or did they have any effect on you at all, that you were taking the lead in an agency that was mired or involved in a lot of complex litigation at the time?
Yeah, well, I think the lawsuits highlighted some of the problems. I mean, most of them didn't go to fruition. Some of them were settled. But there were things that the agency was doing that were clearly inappropriate. It was, pumping people's stomachs, that sort of thing, that under the mere suspicion of requirement, are pretty easy to meet.
Opening
but
the
there
doors
were things
to
that
invasive
just, that should
behaviors.
Should
right.
not be done only in the rarest of circumstances. So I think those lawsuits, some of them had merit and some of them were frivolous, but they highlighted some of the issues that had to be addressed.
Is it one of your approaches, or is it your approach at all, to focus on the negatives or the criticisms about the agencies that you were approaching when you came in to address those first, or were you more concerned with implementing your priorities?
No, I think you have to look at the negatives. Some in law enforcement, you're always going to have some negativity. People are always going to be accusing you of something. But I think they can be a window into what the challenges are and what some of the problems are, and give you an avenue to address.
Now, after you left there, you went to the private sector for a little while.
Right.
And you were with Bear Stearns.
Yes.
Until we had 9/11.
Correct.
And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is, after 9/11, I know you came back. And you were involved in the rapid response team. What was the transition like for you to leave the private sector and come back into a governmental type position doing more police type work?
Well, I was happy to do it. I lived, my wife and I lived just a block and a half away from the World Trade Center. I was at the Bear Stearns.
In New York.
In New York City. I was in Midtown Manhattan at Bear Stearns when the attack took place. But we were affected personally. I was asked by the Bloomberg staff to endorse Mayor Bloomberg. I had never endorsed anybody before or whatever, so I did that. And he did not expect to win election. He spent a lot of money, but he thought he was going to lose. And I was with him election night.
Why did you endorse?
Because I thought, obviously, 9/11 was a game changer, that we needed a proven manager, somebody who...
And I'm asking you only because I know from your book that you tried to maintain independence and not play party politics based on different administrations that came and went, either at the local level or the state or national level. And that's why I ask you, it seemed... Even when I was reading the story, like, I wanted to know more about why at that point, based on all that was going on, did you decide to actually endorse politically a specific candidate?
It was a very uncertain time in New York City right after 9/11. A lot of gloom and doom. People, all the pundits were predicting another terrorist attack. It wasn't if but when. Crime was going to go up. America's crime-fighting mayor, Rudy Giuliani, was leaving. The budget was hit as a result of 9/11. So I thought that the other candidates were not up to the job, having known them, compared to a Bloomberg who had made a fortune, smart guy. I knew him a little bit before that. I mean, I knew of him, and I had some meetings with him before that.
You're listening to former New York City Police Commissioner Ray Kelly, whose new memoir is Vigilance, My Life Serving America and Protecting Its Empire City. He's joined in conversation by San Francisco Deputy of Chief of Staff and Public Safety Director Paul Henderson on BINA, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. BINA is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And it was after that, when we all know what happened next, is that Bloomberg came in and tell us about that conversation with you in terms of coming back into your old position.
Yeah. Well, he called me the next day after election night. The next day, Mayor Bloomberg called me, asked me if I wanted to be police commissioner. And then in the run-up to actually taking office in January, in the book, we talk about putting together plans to sort of transform the department into a counterterrorism entity, along with crime fighting. We developed the three C's, we call it crime prevention, counterterrorism, crime suppression, I should say, counterterrorism, and community relations. And in the area of counterterrorism, we believed that we had to do something different. The city had been attacked twice successfully, all sorts of predictions that it was going to happen again. So we wanted to do something substantively and symbolically. As I say, there's just a lot of gloom in those days. We did a lot of things. We brought in, we honed our language skills, very robust recruitment effort. And we now have in the NYPD police officers born in 106 countries. No other department can come close to that in the world. And we were used those folks to use their language skills, and we sent
to do police work
people to Berlitz to rate them as to where they fell. We brought in people from the CIA, from the retired FBI, DEA, analysts from the top schools in the country, Yale, Harvard, military academies. We even assigned people overseas. There's 11 cities where there are NYPD officers, but because of that diversity, we were able to put them in countries where they fit right in.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that leads me to the next thing that I wanted to talk about. Did you get criticism at all for having your officers and doing work outside of the city and outside of the country, actually?
Yeah. Well, we got some criticism for being outside the city. I sent some people to do investigations in other states,
right,
quite frankly. Don't forget, New York was a city that was attacked twice with 2,700 people killed. So, the NYPD has 54,000 employees. It's the biggest police department in the country. So you're able to muster the talents and skills to go to other places, working with other departments, working with police departments in other parts of the country.
And how did you tie that work externally into the work that you were doing locally?
Yeah, well, their mission was to act as listening posts and tripwires for anything that could affect New York City. Sometimes there were multiple threats that might involve other locations in New York. But secondly, to be able to respond to a terrorist event, either in that country or a country that they could reach. We did that. We sent people to Mumbai. They did a terrific job. We sent them to Nairobi when the shopping center was attacked.
Right.
And so, yes, it gave us granular information about how to protect the city, some practices that were going on in other locations. And it was funded, is still funded, by a foundation. It's not funded by tax levy monies.
Right.
And that, it was because, we could see someone understandably complaining their car was broken into in Queens and you have somebody in Abu Dhabi,
what
should be watching my car.
Right.
So anyway, it worked out and it's still
I get those phone calls.
It's still in place. You can relate.
Yeah. How did you manage the interagency relations in terms of sharing and coordinating the work that you did in a local police jurisdiction with both state and federal agencies that were either surrounding you or in those remote locations?
Well, we the primary vehicle for getting information, intelligence information, is the Joint Terrorism Task Force. Now, the FBI greatly expanded it when after 9/11. So it is now, well, over, may even be close to 100 now. But the first one started in New York City. So it is a joint operation where you'll have the FBI sort of as the jug in the middle, and refrigerator magnets on it would be the agencies. It's not marbleized. But that's still how we got a lot of information. Now, there'll always be some dust-ups because agencies want to do a good job. There's competition. But generally speaking, it worked out well.
And overall, did you feel like the role that you took in terms of expanding the department to work with all of these agencies was something that made the department better? And if so, why?
Yeah. Well, we had 16 plots against the city, which are mentioned in the book, each one of them. This is on Bloomberg Watch. And none came to fruition. As a result of good work on the part of the NYPD, good work on the part of the FBI, good work together, and sheer luck. There was one case in particular that we knew nothing about. Faisal Shahzad drove right into Times Square on May 1st of 2010, was on anybody's radar screen, tried to blow his car up with propane tanks and fertilizer. He received a formula when he was in Pakistan. He was a naturalized U.S. citizen born in Pakistan. He goes there to be trained. He wants to do something, you know, get back at the U.S. I think his particular issue was Abu Ghraib, which had surfaced in a few other terrorist plots. So he has a plan, a formula. He's told to go and accumulate this material to build a bomb. But he thinks that he will be identified, at least he'll look suspicious when he starts to accumulate this material. So instead of buying M80 firecrackers, which are pretty powerful, he buys M88 firecrackers. He goes to Pennsylvania and buys M88 lesser potency. The same thing with the fertilizer that he was told to get, because he thought at a certain level it would be reported to the federal government.
A trigger.
Anyway, he puts this all together. He drives into Times Square. He detonates it. The only thing that happens is smoke that comes out. He walks away, and he thinks the car is going to blow up. And it's right next to the Marriott Hotel. And if it had gone off, and Times Square in 2010 and now, it's packed with people. So it would have killed a lot of people, would have caused a lot of damage. He's ultimately arrested. We do an investigation looking at the hidden VIN number on the vehicle and able to determine who sold him the car.
The vehicle.
We identified him. He gets to Kennedy Airport. This happens on Saturday night. He gets to Kennedy Airport on Monday night. Actually, we knew where he lived. The JTTF knew where he lived in Connecticut. Went to his house. He had already left. He gets on a plane that pulls away from the gate, going to Abu Dhabi, and the plane is brought back, and he's taken into custody now. Interestingly enough, we knew his name, but he was not placed on the no-fly list because that's done on a weekly basis. So we had to wait another week to get his name on the no-fly list. But the point is that, you know, you got to be right every time. This guy, we were very, very lucky with him. Could have caused a lot of damage, and nobody was looking at him.
I want to shift a little bit and talk about some of the bigger pictures in terms of the role that you played with a local jurisdiction and tie it into a lot of the things that are timely right now in terms of police, local policing, and how they are addressed throughout this country in terms of race and justice reforms. And I know this is something that you have a lot of experience with. If I can start you off by taking you back a little bit, and specifically, I want to talk about diversity. Now, I know when you first became police commissioner the very first time, your very first act on your very first day was appearing on the radio talking about encouraging communities of color to come and join the police department. Can you talk to me a little bit or share with us a little bit about your perspective on diversity and its importance or significance with a police department?
I think it's critical. I think you want to strive to reflect the communities that you serve as much as possible. It's the right thing to do, and quite frankly, it makes your job easier. So when I became police commissioner the first time, put on a major effort to increase the African-American population in the department. And I did it through black churches, and I still submit it could be done done today. Mayor Dinkins was the mayor. And we were very successful in getting applicants. Unfortunately, what happened was there was a requirement coming in that you needed 60 college credits to be a police officer. But it did work in terms of getting a significant number of minority applicants to sign up and take the test. Yeah, I think it's an important element. And the department now, New York City Police Department, is about the population of the city is 23% African American. The department is about 16%, which the gap is not that bad, certainly when you look at other cities. The city is 27% Hispanic. The police department is 27% Hispanic. And then you have lots of other diversity that I mentioned before throughout the department.
So contextually for today, and an analysis of police departments, do you feel like diversity is one of the challenges, or is it a less significant challenge for law enforcement agencies?
No, it's still a challenge. I think there are reasons why it's, you know, difficult to do. There is an effort to bring African-American males into policing throughout the country. But a lot of talented young people can go other places and do much better. Or they don't like the police or don't want to be part of the police. Or some instances, they may have a criminal record that prevents them from doing it, or at least even in their minds it prevents them from doing it. So there's a lot of hurdles to overcome.
Yeah, and I want to talk a little bit about, I think everyone is waiting and wants to hear a little bit about some of the programs and policies that were developed under you while you were police commissioner. And I want to talk a little bit about the stop and frisk. Now, I know that you have said in the past that you feel misrepresented by individuals who have challenged you on the appropriateness of the program. Has your opinion or position changed about either how you developed and contemplated the program based on that criticism, or do you still feel the same way now after the litigation, conversations,
I definitely feel the same way. It's not a program. It is a fundamental tool that police officers need. That's what we pay them to do, to intercede when there's suspicious activity. This is based, you know, in the common law. It's a Supreme Court case, Terry versus Ohio. It's codified in every state in the union. And that basically, to sum up, what does it say? If a police officer is abroad in a public place and he reasonably suspects that someone is about to commit a crime, is committing a crime, or has committed a crime, he can stop and question that individual as to what they're doing. If they can articulate a fear,
a consensual
they can do
encounter.
A reasonable, or can do a pat-down. Now, litigation in New York started in 1999. It was brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Correct.
The plaintiffs are somewhat fungible. So, I mean, they move plaintiffs in and out, but the prime mover was the Center for Constitutional Rights. And it goes through, there's an agreement on the part of the city, a stipulation, and when that agreement ends, they bring another action, all in front of the same judge.
Correct.
Shirishinam, which But we can talk more about that in any event.
How would you address the criticism from those advocates that would say that those encounters were disproportionate for the communities of color?
Well, disproportionate in number, that's for sure. The question is why. Now, we propose in this case, in 2006, I brought in the RAND Corporation, been around for 100 years, to tell us what is the metric, what is the criteria to determine whether or not there's racial profiling going on. Well, they said, first of all, I can tell you what it isn't. It can't be census data, because the natural consequence of that would be stopping men, women 50%, women 50% men. It can't be arrest data, because your arrest policies can be inherently biased. What they submitted is that a reasonable criteria would be the description given by the victims of violent crime, of the perpetrators of violent crime. Now, in New York City, those descriptions run about 69% African-American. The stops, historically, certainly for the last several years, have been 53% African-American. So you can see a gap there. Now, disproportionate, you know, you can argue that it is, but, you know, the question is why. Is there more crime, more activities in community of colors? Yeah. Yes,
but in the litigation that was surrounding the process, wasn't that analysis predicated on both collecting and disseminating information and accurate data about...
Well, first of all, the judge refused to accept that demand, so it was never admitted in the court. The judge, by the way, after she makes the decision of indirect racial profiling, a term that nobody ever heard before, she's removed from the case by the appellate division.
After her ruling.
Because of pretrial partiality. This is the same appellate division that was going to hear the appeal of the case that Mayor Bloomberg brought. Mayor de Blasio, when he came into office, killed the appeal.
Right. So, and you were removed from the litigation personally.
I was removed, yeah. But, you know, I wasn't going to be involved in it. I, in that job, you get sued literally every day.
Yeah.
So, had other things to do.
I can imagine.
But I think there's a couple of points that I just want to make out. When I was a police officer stopping someone, you didn't make out a form. You didn't put it in a record unless it was a problem. You know, we tried to change that. As a matter of fact, the city council demanded that we change it. So we required police officers to fill out these reports when they stop somebody. We want to know who they were stopping, why they
encounter
were stopping.
Encounter forms, basically.
Encounters. So the highest number in 2011 was 685,000. Now, that sounds like a big, big number.
That is a big number.
No, well, it. By the way, in Los Angeles in 2009, they stopped 875,000.
That's a big number, too.
Well, you got to look at it in context. The NYPD has 23 million citizen contacts a year, 12 million calls to the 911 system, 500,000 summonses, 400,000 arrests. Everything is bigger there. Now, that number translates into less than one stop a week by a patrol officer and less than one pat-down every 2 weeks by a patrol officer.
Well, and while that's true, I got to tell you, I don't want to be stopped once a week.
But it is a tool that police officers need in their toolkit. It's not a panacea by any means. But it, as I say, this is what they're paid to do.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features former New York City Police Commissioner Ray Kelly, whose new memoir is Vigilance, My Life Serving America and Protecting Its Empire City. He's joined in conversation by San Francisco Deputy of Chief of Staff and Public Safety Director Paul Henderson. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
It's what they're paid to do, but I think if we're focused on what the challenge is to the program has been and what the challenge has been specifically from disenfranchised communities or from the communities of colors that felt that they were unfairly targeted disproportionately for those encounters, which is, you know, essentially what the first court found and affirmed, even though that appeal removed that decision, was that those encounters were, as I said, just disproportionate in terms of what the police action should have been based on an objective review of facts and an objective review of collected data about what those encounters were.
In the lawsuit, the expert for the plaintiff looks at 4 million stops over a decade.
Right.
He finds that only 6% of them are questionable constitutionally.
Right, but to the degree you have a small number of individuals that are affected disproportionately or unfairly, even if the majority are fair, if there's a policy that includes that practice, is it a fair criticism to say that that practice needs to be challenged or reviewed?
Well, it was reviewed. We put in a major training evolution. We used attorneys, we used experienced executives to train everybody in the department about how to do this. Now, let's look at some, as I say, it's not the be-all and end-all. We had a lot of other strategies that worked. Under the Bloomberg administration, there were 9,500 fewer murders than there were in the 12 years before. Mayor Bloomberg is in for 12 years before, 9,500.
Right.
If history is any guide, those lives saved are young men of color, because that's who's being killed on the streets of New York City and other cities as well.
And I would agree with you, but I would also say that that trend was reflected in a lot of other cities that didn't have the same program.
Well, it's not a program. Every city is doing it. Cities don't measure it, don't record it, but I can tell you the stop rate in Baltimore, stop rate in Philadelphia, stop rate in Los Angeles, certainly per office, the stop rate in Chicago, higher than it was in New York at the time.
And why do you think that New York was singled out for having this pretextual context with their behavior?
Well,
if this is something that occurs on a daily basis through every major city.
New York is the litigation capital of the world.
I would argue with you that, oh, I know.
Well, you're probably a race at the bottom here.
Yeah.
Right, in terms of litigation. No, I mean, and I think the judge had something to do with it. The judge was involved in this matter for 12 years. Mayor de Blasio ran on this issue. And in 2013, when he had his campaign, he put forward the notion that there was a schism between the police and communities of color, based on stop questioning first. He did it at a time when it was a 70% approval rating.
But do you believe that was unwarranted or an unfair accusation?
I do. I thought it was a false narrative. I had a 75% approval rating after 11 plus years in office. That is not an indication of a schism. He did it skillfully. His political handlers did it skillfully. So he attacked the police, and it all sort of came together, this lawsuit and the mayor's election campaign.
And do you feel like his approval rating, for whatever reason, or your approval rating at the same time, was at all tied to just the results of this process that was going on? Or was it fair to challenge his politics or your policies about these encounters? Was that fair at all?
Well, this is inevitable. They've been building up for years for this litigation. I mean, this was a plan that was years in the making. People don't like it. In the meantime, if you go out to communities of color, grassroots, it's kind of a 50-50 proposition. You know, they want it done with dignity, with respect. Nobody wants
Correct.
to be abused. But they see it as something that keeps the community safe. Now, the advocates are not, generally speaking, from those communities.
Yes, everybody supports public safety. But then the balance is, you know, communities also don't want to live in police states or feel yeah. like they're disproportionately targeted for whatever reason in terms of, and that's sometimes subjective, but sometimes not.
But there's a disproportionate amount of crime in those communities. 97% of the shooting victims in New York City are black or Latino. 90% of the murder victims are black or Latino. People say they're over-policing in those communities. How do the police get there? They're called by people in those communities. That's how police go.
Yeah, and I wouldn't argue with you. I would agree that the highest level of disproportionality that exists in the criminal justice system is in communities of color that are victims and witnesses of crimes. But separate from that, in terms of an administrative or managerial approach to coordinating policing in those communities, do you think it was a fair criticism for you or for your administration to be challenged on those encounters
It was inevitable. It could happen in any city. New York had sort of the stars were aligned for this. You had the judge. As I said, you had this litigation started in 1999 where they required. Here's an example. The judge in the first case designs or has a lot of input in designing a form. And the problem with the forms in the past is there was a narrative that you couldn't read.
Right.
So they made it a forced choice, and it was furtive movements, that sort of thing, that the judge, you know, mandated. So we changed the form. In the second case, the judge criticizes the form because you don't have a narrative. So, you know,
you
can't win.
And you alluded to it being inevitable. And I think that inevitability in terms of challenging those practices when we talk about this process in a larger scale, beyond just New York, of what we see in the national headlines, of what we see in big cities. And this, again, speaks to some of the things that we were talking about in terms of the current state of justice reforms. And you talk about this in your book, and I want to kind of close with these ideas of justice reforms that are ongoing now. There are programs even evolving out of movements like the Black Lives Matter movement or the 2020 movement addressing justice reforms. You talk about some very specific solutions, and I'm curious as to where you are with those solutions now, and I just want to list the things that you've talked about, and I want you to talk about them collectively in terms of having law enforcement agencies adopting body cameras, diversity, demilitarizing equipment and behaviors, increased training, and community partnerships.
Right. So,
is that the solution right now?
Yeah, I mean, there's no magic wand, but I think these things, if put in place, will make a significant move towards regaining some of the trust that has been lost through the horrific
events.
Some of the videos that we've seen, like the North Charleston, South Carolina, where Walter Scott is gunned down, shot. That is an out-and-out murder. And that, in a lot of people's minds, the suspicion is confirmed. It appears that the planting evidence. Cameras, yeah, that train has left the station. I think the department should embrace cameras. One of the reasons being that you would have to believe that no sane person wearing a camera, police officer, would conduct himself like in, you know, the murder of Walter Scott. And I believe that many times you see videos that start in the middle. Somebody has taken the video. You don't see the beginning of it. Now police officers are wearing the camera. You at least have the potential of seeing the whole event. And I would submit you're going to see a lot more overwhelming amount of heroic work, good work, beneficial work than you will see in terms of inappropriate conduct. Training, yeah, you need a lot more scenario-based training. And thanks to Mayor Bloomberg's administration, $1 billion police academy was built in New York City to allow, there's a lot more space to do scenario-based in training. I think, you know, you want to have role-playing on the part of the police. The notion of demilitarizing the police, I absolutely agree with that. The optics are bad. It should be on the streets of U.S. cities. It was a good faith effort on the part of the Department of Defense in the 90s. They had a lot of extra equipment. Hey, let's give it to the police department. You know, they can use it. It just looks bad. It looked bad in Ferguson. Weapons of war don't belong in civilian policing organizations.
Well,
they can be kept centrally.
With,
you know,
the narrative that we're seeing, or the videos where we're seeing where they're used in communities of color or in citizens in various cities, that's a problem. I'm curious, you mentioned the training, and I'm specifically asking about cultural competency or implicit bias in terms of training. And are you talking about specifically training at the beginning in academies or throughout careers for law enforcement agents?
I think both. There's an awful lot of training going on. There's a lot of police chiefs out there that are pretty savvy. And this type of training, cultural awareness, going on for many, many years. But there's only so much training. And I would submit that I think the pool of people that go into policing has to be, you know, looked at. I think everyone...
The pipeline.
Everyone going into policing should be required to have a four-year college degree. We require teachers throughout America in the most rural areas to have a four-year college degree. We give tremendous power to police officers, literally the power of a life or death. And most departments don't even require the 60 credits I talked about. I mean, I looked at it in New York City. I would have liked to have done it. There was a belief that you couldn't do it politically because it was an assumption that it would adversely impact on minority recruitment, when, in fact, we showed that minority recruits had a higher credit level than majority recruits. I think we have to do a better job of testing for entry into policing. Something that's come up is bullying. You know, what is the effect on a police officer who's been the victim of bullying or has been a bully? I don't know the answer to that, but these are some of the things that we just need to know more about who's policing us than we currently know.
Yeah, I really enjoyed your book, and I really enjoyed those concepts that you closed with in an analysis based on your experiences, education, training, and management. I'm curious, and I'll let you close with this, how would you compare your ideas now about policing and law enforcement with the theories being presented in the 21st century policing documents coming from the federal government?
Well, that's interesting because a lot of the ideas that are in the federal government report are from the 80s. They've been around for a long time. Some have merit, some don't, some are someplace in the middle. One of the things that I thought was somewhat bizarre is that in the second or third item, and I think it listed about 100 recommendations,
right,
police departments admit that they've been wrong. That they've conducted themselves inappropriately. I fail to see the merit in that.
Don't you think that there is a value in acknowledging to communities that have been... I mean, there's been many lawsuits. There's been a lot of...
Oh, you're a lawyer. There's been a lot of frivolous lawsuits.
There's been a lot of frivolous lawsuits, but not all the lawyers do now. There's lawyers that do a lot of good work and do meaningful practices,
sure.
But there has been a history. Is it really your position that law enforcement agencies should not retroactively look back and apologize for...
Okay, we're going to move forward. You tell me, you confess or you admit to doing some sort of...
Correct.
Heinous act,
right.
And then we'll be able to move forward. People don't do that. If you want to get together... Fine. Let's move forward together. Admit that I wasn't there 30 years ago or 40 years ago or 10 years ago. So why should I, the chief of the department, admit there was wrongdoing? I don't know if there was. I don't know if there wasn't. I failed to see the merit in that. I just thought it was a strange thing to put in, like the third element. And, oh, by the way, you know, admit you're wrong and then do this next 100 things.
Right. And you see how we're ending now with this clear disagreement. I absolutely disagree. I think in order to move on, if there have been transgressions, there has to be an acknowledgement that allows a community to heal, to say that you know that you can do better. Because if you don't know that you've done wrong in the past, how do you know that you can do better in the future?
That's and with that, we're going to move on.
Because we could keep going. Yeah.
So please put your hand up if you have a question, and we're coming. I'm going to get you first right here in the front.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Kelly. Good evening. I'll assume you can't see me because of the light, but I want to make sure you're aware that there are a number of command-level personnel from the San Francisco Police Department here, as well as the audience should know that. In fact, Chief Sir, who couldn't be here, gives you his best. I'd wish you could speak more on the role that law enforcement plays with the community before the issues even develop, particularly when it comes to children, educational issues, and employment that are really the driving forces that disenfranchise communities and cause these needs for greater responses.
You know, from my vantage point, having been in certainly the police department for over 40 years, but in other law enforcement agencies, I would say that the relationship between the communities and the police, and not just in New York but in other cities, up to the terrible events that have happened in Ferguson, North Charleston, those sorts of things, was better than it's ever been. Tremendous work is being done to work with communities, understand communities, to make departments more reflective of the communities that they serve. No question about it that these events set the profession back somewhat. But compared to where we were, and I can relate to this, 40 years ago, one of the recommendations I have in the book is that we share tactical information with the communities. You know, what happens is the elected officials or other leaders, a warrant is going to be executed someplace. I think you need a trusted cadre of leaders to say, this is what we're going to do, rather than having them surprised like everybody else. And so some of these things, as you know, can, you know, not go exactly according to plan. So you want police officers to respect the community they serve, community respect police officers.
So I want to thank you all so much for coming tonight. Thanks to Paul Henderson. Most of all, Ray Kelly. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was former New York City Police Commissioner Ray Kelly, whose new memoir is Vigilance, My Life Serving America and Protecting Its Empire City. He was joined in conversation by San Francisco Deputy Chief of Staff and Public Safety Director Paul Henderson. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espelay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.